Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Tell Them a Story when we come back. You know, we Americans may hold the dubious honor of being the most litigious people in the world, but when it comes to law, we seem to be among the most ignorant. Today, most Americans feel powerless to resist the evils that they see perpetrated against our liberties, our privacy, and our property by these powerful government agencies, these multinational corporations, the lobbies, and the news media. But you know, we don't have to remain helpless. The institution designed by God and incorporated into our Constitution and Bill of Rights is called the judicial power. The courts are the proper repository for the protection of our rights, our liberties, and our property. It's not in the Congress, and it's not in the political process. Now, did you know, for instance, that the privilege against self-incrimination is neither accorded to the passive resistant nor to the person who is ignorant of his rights, not to one who is indifferent thereto? It is a fighting clause, and its benefits can be retained only by sustained combat. And it cannot be claimed by an attorney or a solicitor. It's valid only when insisted upon by a belligerent claimant in person. Now, that comes from a case called U.S. versus Johnson. That's why I contend that we should listen more to our judges and less to our politicians and lawyers. Now, listen to what that judge said in that statement. He said, "Your rights cannot be claimed by your attorney or your solicitor. Your rights can only be claimed by you, the belligerent claimant, in person." Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. Our school, Courtroom Strategy and Procedure, is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Click on to our archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org. All right, we've been talking about this thing of Tell Them a Story. Don Hewitt was asked one time what the success of 60 Minutes was, and he said the success is tell them a story. Everybody wants to hear a story. Everybody likes a story, like the story of David and Goliath. And there's a moral to the story. You can beat City Hall. All of these stories, like Brer Rabbit and the Tar Baby, or Brer Rabbit making a dollar a minute, have a moral to the story. They educate. They teach us something. Now, there's a couple of modalities here in education. One of them that we use here in the United States, the most common modality, is called memorization. It's really indoctrination by memorization. We give information, and then we test and see if you've got that information, but we don't teach understanding and wisdom. Memorization doesn't lend itself to wisdom and understanding, but a story does. A story lends itself to understanding and understanding to wisdom. Now, there's a book in the Bible that deals with knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. It's the book of Proverbs. And right off the bat, the creator of the universe tells us that these are the Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, the king of Israel. To know wisdom and instruction, to perceive the words of understanding, to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, and judgment, and equity, to give subtlety to the simple, to the young man knowledge and discretion, A wise man will hear and will increase learning, and a man of understanding will attain unto wise counsels. To understand a proverb and the interpretation thereof, the words of the wise and their dark sayings. The fear of the Eternal is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. Now that's quite a mouthful. Do we want memorization, or do we want understanding and wisdom? It's a choice that we have to make. Let me give you an example of how this works. When we talk about education, a story triggers your imagination, and it's the basis of education, such as Samson and Delilah, David and Goliath, Joshua's long day. Indoctrination triggers your vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear, and it's the basis of subjugation and memorization. For instance, Muslims memorize the Quran, and then they go out and commit suicide by killing themselves and a bunch of other people. They're religious, and they're knowledgeable, but they lack understanding and they lack wisdom. The kamikaze pilot in World War II, he too was educated, he was trained, he memorized, he followed instructions, he followed his orders, and then committed suicide and killed himself and a bunch of others. Now, the Bible is the basis of education, and it's full of stories and parables. It uses the story as the means by which we communicate knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. Liberal arts is the basis of memorization and indoctrination, such as evolution, economics, theories, and science. Now, we have choices to make. Choices end up in outcomes. There's a cause and an effect. There's a result that comes from our actions. So wisdom is the ability to foresee the outcome of our actions today. If we had wisdom, we would apply our wisdom to the paper money system, as we talked about yesterday, and then we would have an outcome. Now, I told you a story yesterday about the paper money system between 1690 and 1783, and it was all bad. All of the colonies tried paper money, and it always ended up in bankruptcy, unemployment. It ended up in a depression, a collapse of the economy. All kinds, everything that you don't want, can't, you shouldn't have, and are trying to avoid. Same things that we're having today with this general worldwide economic meltdown that's going on around us. And so the solution that these people are offering us is the same old hackneyed solutions that got us into the trouble or the problem to start with, and that is paper money. Paper money has a long history, boys and girls. Marco Polo is the guy that discovered paper money in China back in the 12th century and brought it to Europe. So the Chinese are the people that invented it. They tried it four times between 1200 and the present day, and it has done nothing but result in collapse of the economy and poverty. Now, they've got the longest history. We, here in the West, we've tried it in every country in the West, and it's always had exactly the same result. And you know, that's the definition of insanity. It's where somebody does something over and over again, expecting a different result each time. Well, let's see if we can delineate wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. Listen to this story. You and I go to the driver's education course, and they give us the book, and the book says, when you see a sign that says slow to 35, it's the law, you must slow to 35. You and I both have the same knowledge. Now, we both understand the law, we both understand the road sign, they show us pictures of the road sign, and now we're out driving, and we're going down the road. Now, you are driving, and you see a sign that says 35. And you rely upon your knowledge, and you say, now I remember the book, I remember the sign. You look down at your speedometer, and you're going 70. And you say, oh my, I can't drive 70 around this turn, because the sign says 35, and I remember the law, and I've memorized it. I know it was on page 9. You have knowledge. Now, do you have any understanding from which you can apply that knowledge and understanding and apply or come to a conclusion as to what would happen if you kept driving at 70 miles an hour? Now, you've never taken this turn at 70 miles an hour before, so you don't have any direct experience. It's kind of like standing on top of the Empire State Building. You've never stepped off of a 100-story building before, so from your own first-hand experience, you don't know what's going to happen. Are you going to fall up? Are you going to fall left? Are you going to fall right? Or are you going to fall down? And if you fall down, how fast will you fall? Will you get hurt at the bottom? How do you know? You've never done it before. Well, now, it's very obvious that we can't all of us have this experience. So we rely then upon somebody else's experience. Has anybody else ever stepped off of this 100-story building? And what happened to them? Did they fall up? Did they fall left? Did they fall right? Or did they fall down? When they got to the bottom, did they get hurt? So from the experiences of others, we learn that we better not step off the building because the last guy that did this got killed. Now that's the value of the story, because the story imparts understanding, the understanding imparts wisdom, so that even without having done it myself, I can visualize the ultimate outcome of this because other people have done this before me. And now because of those stories of what has happened before me, I know what the probable outcome is going to be if I do that. Okay, now that's what knowledge, understanding, and wisdom is all about. Now, you come to the turn and you slow down. Nobody's ever told you a story. And you don't know what the outcome might be if you were to continue driving at 70 miles an hour. So you slow to 35 and you negotiate the turn and you drive on down the road safely and everything's fine. And we call this education, and you went to driver's ed, and by God, that driver's ed saved your life and everything's fine. Now I, on the other hand, I'm driving down the road, and I've been to driver's ed, and I have the same knowledge that you have. But I've got one more little factoid that I can apply to this equation. My daddy told me a story, and he said, once upon a time there was a man who was driving down the road, and he saw a sign that said 35, and he was driving 70. And he said to himself, I wonder what would happen if I took this turn at 70 miles an hour. So he didn't slow down, and he kept going at 70 miles an hour. And he noticed that he had full control of his automobile. When he turned the steering wheel, the car responded. When he stepped on the gas, the car responded. When he stepped on the brake, the car responded. And then he arrived at the turn at 70 miles an hour. He began steering the car and noticed that the car responded to his steering. He kept his foot on the gas. And as he got further and further into the turn, he noticed that he was picking up G-load. He had to hang on tightly to the wheel to keep it from, to keep himself from being thrown to the other side of the car. But he didn't slow down. He could have. At that point in time, he could have stepped on the brake, taken his foot off the gas. He could steer the car. He had control. As he got further and further into the turn, the laws of physics took over, and the car became airborne. Once the car became airborne, the man tried to steer the car, and it didn't respond. He stepped on the gas, and it didn't respond. He stepped on the brake, and it didn't respond. The car now was airborne, and it was headed toward the guardrail, in fact, over the top of the guardrail. It went down the bank, hit some trees, and the man was killed. Now, I'm armed with a story. And the story now triggers my imagination. And my imagination says, oh my, if that's the outcome, If the events that I have control over get out of control, they will degenerate into a circumstance in which I will lose control, which will then kill me. Since I don't want to die, I think I'll slow down to 35. Now, let's try this scenario again. You're driving down the road, and you look ahead, and you see a guardrail up the road, and you see a turn. But there's no sign. And because there's no sign that says slow to 35, having memorized the book, you continue on at 70 miles an hour. As you approach the turn, you can see that this turn is very similar to the turn that said slow to 35 when you saw the sign, but there's no sign in this case. Well, if there's no sign, there's no reason to slow down. Nobody told me to slow down. So it must be okay to drive 70 miles an hour around this turn. As you drive into the turn, you notice that you've got steering, acceleration, brake. Everything works fine. You're in perfect control. But as you drive around the turn, your car becomes airborne. Now you've reached critical mass. The car is out of control. You step on the gas, no response. You step on the brake, there's no response. You turn the wheel, there's no response. It's out of control. Now you can unbuckle your seatbelt. You could buckle your seatbelt. You could jump into the back seat. You could put your hands up in front of your face. But you don't have any control over the automobile. You have lost control. You didn't have any understanding or wisdom with which to apply to the circumstance when no sign was there to guide you, direct you. Your indoctrination now has failed you because you could not visualize the possible or probable outcome of driving around this turn at 70 miles an hour. Now I come along, having heard the story. I'm driving down the road. Now I too see the guardrail. I too see the turn. And I notice that there's no sign that tells me to slow to 35. But because of my story, because of my understanding, I'm able now to apply wisdom to the circumstance. I say to myself, aha, this turn looks very similar to the one with the sign that says 35. Now, the one that said 35 on it, if I go at 70 miles an hour, the outcome was the car becomes airborne and the fellow ends up dead. Therefore, even though I don't see a sign here, the circumstances remind me of that story. Maybe I'd better slow down to 35. And sure enough, as I slow down to 35 and negotiate the turn, I say, gee, they should have put a sign up back there. They didn't. Now, my understanding is a step further. There are some circumstances in which there might not be a sign. There might not be somebody there to tell me what to do. There might not be somebody there to direct me. I might have to think for myself. I might have to think for myself and arrive at a conclusion because I can visualize an outcome. And that's what wisdom is all about. Wisdom is the ability to apply the lessons of the past, the lessons of other people, the lessons of other circumstances, and then come to a conclusion. What's the probable outcome from this? What's the probable outcome of spending an extra $29 trillion into the economy that's already in meltdown? If we create more and more paper money, what's the probable outcome based upon history? What happened in Hungary when they printed a lot of money? What happened in Germany when they printed a lot of money? What happened in the United States in 1783 when the continental currency collapsed? These are the stories that we all need to hear in order for us today to learn from the mistakes of the past. Somebody has to tell us the story. We haven't been hearing the stories. Now, yesterday I told you the story of paper money. Now, listen to what George Washington and Richard Henry Lee and George Mason, some of the founding fathers who wrote our Constitution, wrote into our monetary system, you know, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin, a tender and payment of debt. Listen to these stories, and then let's see if we can apply these stories to today, and then let's you and I apply that story, apply understanding, and see if we can come to a wise decision. Listen to this. George Washington, in his circular letter of June 1783, to the governors of the several states, wrote that honesty will be found on every experiment to be the best and the only true policy. Being convinced that arguments deduced from this topic could with pertinency and force be made use of against any attempt to procure a paper currency, George Washington in 1783, with the collapse of the continental currency, in his circular letter to the governors, said, "Hey, do you see what just happened to us? Let's see if we can learn from this, and let's not do this paper trick again." Now, in June 1783, Alexander Hamilton, in Resolutions for a New Constitution of the United States of America, set forth explicitly, he said, quote, "To emit an unfunded paper as the sign of value ought not to continue a formal part of the Constitution, nor ever hereafter to be employed, being in its nature pregnant with abuses, and liable to be made the engine of imposition and fraud, holding out temptation equally pernicious to the integrity of government and to the morals of the people." Unquote. Well, what do we have today? Did we learn from George Washington and Alexander Hamilton? Going on, in 1783, New Jersey issued 31.25 thousand pounds of notes. In 1786, in New Jersey, an attempt was made to issue a larger amount. William Paterson, subsequently a member of our Supreme Court, resisted the proposal with words as follows. He said, "An increase of paper money, especially if it be a tender, will destroy what little credit is left, will bewilder conscience in the mazes of dishonest speculation, will allure some and constrain others into the perpetuation of knavish acts, will turn vice into a legal virtue, and sanctify iniquity by law. Men have, in the ordinary transactions of life, temptations enough to lead them from the path of rectitude. Why then pass laws for the purpose or give legislative sanction to positive acts of iniquity? Lead us not into temptation is a part of our Lord's prayer, worthy of attention at all times, and especially at the present time." Unquote. Well, in the summer of 1785, Richard Henry Lee, then President of Congress, warned Washington of a plan for issuing a large sum of paper money in the next assembly of their state, adding, as his opinion, quote, "The greatest foes in the world could not devise a more effectual plan for ruining Virginia." Did you hear that? Let me ask you this. If in the summer of 1785, the greatest foes in the world could not devise a more effectual plan for ruining Virginia by emitting paper money, may I then conclude that President Obama emitting $29 trillion worth of money is going to ruin America? I'm just asking the question. I'm telling you the story because we've lived through this before. This is not the first time that we've ever gone broke or destroyed our economy with paper money here in North America. Hell, we've done this three times. Four. We did it from 1690 to 1756, from 1760 to about 1783. That was two. Then in 1783, when the continental currency collapsed, George Mason, who was the architect, you know, of that Article 1, Section 10 section, comes to the fore, and he says, hey, let's banish this paper money forever. Then from 1787 to 1933, we destroyed it again with paper money, with the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. Then we went off gold in 1971, and sure enough, we've come to the point where we've destroyed our economy again. That's the fourth time. And that's here in North America. You know, the Chinese have done it three or four times. And everybody in the world that's ever tried this, all of these banana republics, you know, south of the Rio Grande, we haven't learned anything. And I suspect that it's because we read our economics books and we memorize our lessons. And we learn paper. But nobody tells us the story of what's happened in the past and why we ought to learn from those stories. And again, you know, if you can't learn from history, then you have to learn from your own mistake. If you can't learn from the stories of the past, well, then the only thing you can do is go out here and try it again. You know, you got to go test it. Unfortunately, when you go test it for yourself, you know, you step off the Empire State Building, and by the time you get to the bottom, you know, it's kind of curtains. You know, by the time you get airborne around that turn, you've lost control. And now events are going to take over. So, while you're in control, is the time for you to take action. Because once things spin out of control, kind of like the Titanic, you know, once the thing hits the iceberg, you're out of control. Before you hit the iceberg, you can slow down, you can steer south. There are options that you have available to you. Then the Titanic isn't the first ship to ever hit an iceberg. That isn't the first ship that ever sank after it hit an iceberg. And it probably won't be the last. Icebergs are pretty dangerous, you know, and you got to watch out for them. And if you run into them, you know, you're probably going to get hurt. That's the bottom line. They knew that in 1912. But they deliberately disregarded the stories of the past. So, first of all, you need to hear the story. And secondly, you need to hear and fear. You need to pay attention, you know, what happened to these people in the past. That's what we do here at the law school. The modality of education that we use here is called the Ten Commandment model. We use the story in the parable format in order to impart knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. Knowledge is the information, understanding is the application, and wisdom is being able to look at it and say, the probable outcome is going to be, so here's the action I'm going to take so that I can get the end result that I want, which is the most probable and logical outcome that's going to come from this knowledge and understanding. That's what wisdom is all about. All right, now yesterday I said, I don't pay income tax. And I know right away you said, and all you IRS agents said, oh, why that damn tax protester? I'm not protesting any tax. I'm not trying to abolish the IRS. I'm not trying to convince you people to abolish paper money. I don't care whether you keep the Federal Reserve or not. And the reason for that is I dropped out of the system. See, the income tax is a tax that you pay on income. Income is a criminal occupation. It's a criminal endeavor. And you ought not to be dealing in income. You should be dealing in property. That's what your creator told you to do. But we decided we're going to cut a fat hog in the back and we're going to have income and get rich and we're going to live the good life. Well, okay. Now, you've been doing that in this country now for about 100 years. Now we're coming to the conclusion here. Now, for the nation, the circumstances have now spun out of control. You're not going to stop it now. Car's already in the air. For you personally, you haven't quite got to that point yet, and you could probably take some actions that would at least ameliorate the crash, if not avoid it altogether as an individual and as a family. That's what I would suggest. You know, you're not going to stop the Titanic. The crew, the captain, the officers, the owners, they have an agenda. Their agenda was, we're going to set a new transatlantic record. We're not steering south, and we ain't slowing down. In fact, start another boiler and pour on the steam. Now, there's a probable outcome going to come from this. And if you had the same information that Captain Smith had, and if you applied understanding and wisdom to that, you'd say, you know, I need to get close to a lifeboat here. Maybe I need to start figuring out how to build my own lifeboat. But we now learned from the experience of others on the Titanic. And so now, when we have ships out there in the ocean, you know, they have lifeboats on them for everybody, which they should have had in 1912 on the Titanic. And they didn't. Hell, those people weren't dumb, you know. But they applied memorization. They didn't apply reason, logic, and common sense. They had an agenda, and they followed that agenda. That's the way we educate people today. We have a textbook, and you read the chapter. On Friday, we're going to have a test. And if you can regurgitate that information that you're reading in that chapter, well, then we're going to give you a grade and a degree, and then you can go out and get a job. Nobody ever asks the question, is this chapter true? Is the information that's printed on these pages true, accurate, and correct? Who said so? Have we ever proved all things to hold fast that which is good? I mean, come on, wake up and smell the coffee here, kids. Just because it's in print doesn't mean it's true. Hell, the Russians have books that are in print, and we've got books that are in print, and our books tell us exactly the opposite from what the Russian books tell them. Now, somebody's lying. Somebody's not got this story straight. That's where you're at with evolution and the Bible. Somebody doesn't have this story straight. Somebody's lying to you. Who can prove what they're saying? All right, now, when it comes to income, has it ever occurred to us that perhaps, just a wild thought here, perhaps we could live our lives without any income, which then would obviate the income tax? Well, I took a look at that problem some years ago, and I said, you know, I don't like this income tax. I think I'll stop having income. And I did. I was asked one day, how do you live without income? And the answer is very well, thank you. We were living very well without income, you know, before they came up with this concept of income and income tax with the second and fifth planks to the Communist Manifesto. You know, God, with the Ten Commandment model, has been living quite nicely with property and without income for thousands of years and taught us how to do the same thing. It's that we've been listening to our politicians and our preachers, and they're the ones that have led us astray. So let's give you your mid-course reminder, and we'll come back and we'll take a look at another story here as it relates to the monetary system. Let's see how we can do business and property and stop paying this income tax. Hang on, we'll be back right after this. Now, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. Now, if you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's eight schools and all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Now, once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org. Click on to our archives page, and you can download that yourself. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then we invite you to go to our website at georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, let's see if we can listen to another story here. Let me tell you a story about our monetary system. Back in 1933, President Roosevelt took gold coin out of circulation through the process of a law called House Joint Resolution 192, which was later codified and turned into a statute. The President and the Congress did not take our gold away from us for no good reason. They took our gold away from us because they wanted to implement the first plank to the Communist Manifesto, which calls for the abolition of all right to property. And to do that, we have to take your gold away from you so that you cannot pay your debts at law, and you have to discharge your obligations in equity. That's why we have paper money. It doesn't have anything to do with the expedience of trade or commerce, business, and industry. It has to do with control of the economy and reducing you to a ward of the state. Now, we still had our silver money, silver coin. It's more bulky. But by 1964, our government wanted to take that away from us, too, so they did. They substituted clad coin for the silver coin, and it drove all of the silver coin out of circulation, just like it did in Massachusetts and the colonies when they issued paper money. And it had its desired effect. It put us on a entirely or a totally fiat paper currency. And that's where we are today. Now, in 1986, to remedy a problem that government had because some people in the country weren't paying their taxes and weren't paying their dues and their fines because of Article 1, Section 10, the Congress reinstituted our gold and silver coin by minting it in limited quantities at a mint at West Point, New York. And the representative who was instrumental in getting our gold and silver back was the representative from Texas, Ron Paul. And now we have our gold and silver back. It's in limited supply, but I have all of mine. I don't know about you, but, you know, last time I saw a number, there's 163,000 tons of gold in the world. That's about four Titanics. The Titanic was about 40,000 tons and a little change. Well, 4, 8, 12, 16, it's about 160,000 tons of gold in the world that's been mined above ground that we know about. And it's all in the hands of a few people. And I have all of mine. I don't have very much, but everything that I'm entitled to, I have. I've got it, 16 ounces. Now, I would suggest that everybody in the world have all of theirs. If we divided that 160,000 tons up and everybody in the world had all of their gold, then all of us would have all of our wealth in something tangible. Real property. And after all, that's what property is. Property, remember, we talked about that. We have the subject of property and we have real property. Well, gold and silver coin as property. Now, as a result of that, it is something different than income. Income is not property. And in Anglo-Saxon administration, property is not assessed and it's not taxed as income. That's why I said to you, why don't we stop having income and why don't we concentrate on property? The income comes from that commercial paper. Income is Federal Reserve notes and mortgages and interest. It's called interest income. When we deal in this paper, it can be regulated and controlled. It's illegal. It violates the law of God. And our government and our preachers and politicians and economists have encouraged us to give up our property, our gold, and go to paper money, unjust weights and balances, condemned by God and man. And that's what we're dealing in. And that's why we have an economic crisis. So I'm just throwing this out there, you know. If paper money has caused our economic crisis, has it ever occurred to us to get off the paper money and go back to what doesn't cause economic crisis? That's a wild new concept, isn't it? Now, I don't think that the United States is going to do that. I don't think Great Britain or Germany or anybody else is going to do that, but you and I can. You know, I'm probably the only guy here in Ozark County that deals in gold and silver. You know, that has an economy, a personal economy based upon gold and silver coin. Here at the law school, when we charge tuition, we charge it in gold and silver coin. Guy said to me, he said, how much is your school? And I says, $225 in U.S. gold coin. $225 doesn't sound like a lot, does it? Same price I would have charged in 1950 or 1930. $225 in U.S. gold coin. In 1930, it would have been $90 in U.S. gold coin. I don't think that I've raised my prices. I think the value of your paper's gone down. We're not talking about any more gold in the world. There's no more gold and silver in the world today than there was when Adam and Eve were running around in the garden. The price of gold has not gone up. It hasn't gone down. It's still exactly the same. And the correct price for gold is 16 ounces of silver buys 1 ounce of gold, and 1 ounce of gold buys 16 ounces of silver. It's a bimetallic system created by God himself. And he said, now go dig that gold and silver out of the ground. And when you do, labor puts your money into circulation. And we said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to give a franchise to Goldman Sachs and all the big banks, J.P. Morgan, and let them create money right out of thin air and reduce us to slavery. And that's what we're going to do. And we're going to vote for it on top of it. Well, okay, we did that. Do you think that's really good for you now that they're foreclosing on you and taking your property away from you, or what little property you got left? Now, in 1986, Congress came up with a monetary system. They codified it, and it's in Title 31, Section 5101 through 5112 of the U.S. Code. So why don't you write that down? I'm going to read to you three or four of these statutes over here, and I'll show you how valuable this is. This is really good. I suspect that God himself probably inspired this, kind of like the Bible. I think that all Scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, reproof, correction, and instruction. I suspect that that's the case here, but Here's 5103. It says, United States coins and currency, including Federal Reserve notes and circulating notes of Federal Reserve banks and national banks, are legal tender for all debts, public charges, taxes, and dues. Foreign gold or silver coins are not legal tender for debts. And then I have a little notation here, see Section 5112, G and H. So let me turn the page here, and then I'll read Section G and H of 5112. It says, for purposes of Section 5132A1 of this title, all coins minted under subsection E of this section shall be considered to be numismatic coins. So these new gold and silver coins that are being minted are called numismatic collector coins. They sell for a higher price than the face value on them. And H says that the coins issued under this title shall be legal tender as provided in Section 5103 of Title 31 of the U.S. Code. So not only are they numismatic, they're also legal tender coins, and they have the same value imprinted upon them as $50 bills. So what the Congress of the United States has written up here is a little story, and it's quite a little story. A $50 bill, one of those Federal Reserve notes, and a $50 gold coin have the same value. And if you want to test it, take it in, pay your taxes with it, and see if the IRS will give you $1,200 worth of credit on your taxes for a $50 gold coin. And if they do, then this law doesn't mean what it says. But if they give you $50 credit, well, then it means what it says and says what it means. Now, how could that be of value to us? Well, it's very simple. If we were to practice what we preach, if you and I, were to practice gold and silver instead of Federal Reserve notes, how would that impact upon us? Well, here's what I do. I took a look at this law and I said, you know, this law comports perfectly with our Constitution at Article 1, Section 10, that says no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. It comports perfectly with God's instructions in Exodus 20, for instance, the Ten Commandments, that says thou shalt not steal. It comports perfectly with Deuteronomy 25, verses 13 through 16, that says you're to use just weights and balances. And Leviticus 19, 35 and 36. It comports perfectly with Hale versus Hinkle, Seeger versus U.S., the First Amendment to our Constitution. You know, if you stop and think about it, this gold and silver thing over here fits perfectly with everything that God and our founding fathers told us to do. Now, our Congress has in recent years, you know, the last 25 years, 1986, has said, hey, we're going to give you the means to do that. It's in Title 31, Section 5103 and 5112. So that's what I did. You see, we have a minimum filing requirement in this country. It's $10,700, last time I saw a number. $10,700. Now, when you come to school here and you say to me, well, how many dollars do you want? And I say to you, I want $225 in the new gold coin, $90 in the old gold coin. And so somebody's going to say, well, you know, how many dollars is that? Well, I was in court the other day, and the judge said, well, I don't understand this gold thing over here. How many dollars in real money is that? I kind of chuckle when I hear that. We're so divorced from real money in this country that we think Federal Reserve notes are real money. But in Federal Reserve note dollars, let's just try it. If you had 225, you would have 2 1-ounce gold coins, $50 each. No, you'd have four $50 gold coins, and one $25 gold coin. That's 4.5 ounces of gold. Well, gold's about $1,200 an ounce, so let's go with 4.5 times 1,200 would be about 5,400 Federal Reserve note dollars. 5,400. Now, let's go back to 1930. We didn't have $50 gold coins in those days. We had $20 gold coins. They were 20s. And they had just about the same amount of gold, a little bit less, but it was about an ounce. So in 1930 gold coins, it would be 4 20s, would be 80. That's 4 ounces. And then 1 10 would be $90. Now look what's happened. In 1930, you could have paid me $90 in U.S. gold coin and bought that school. And today, those same 5 coins, 4 20s and a 10, are going to cost you 5,400 Federal Reserve note dollars. Now, do you think that gold has gone up in value from 90 to 5,400, or do you think your paper money has gone down in value from $90 to 5,400? Well, I'll tell you the answer to that riddle. Your value of your paper money has gone to hell. That's what's happened there. I haven't raised my price. Your money is deteriorating right in front of your eyeballs, and your president is printing more money. The April deficit, I just saw this in the Privateer, the April deficit was $380 billion, I believe that was. No, I'll take that back. I guess it was $80 billion, $87 billion. I'm getting ahead of myself here. They were expecting 40. Last year, it was $20 billion for the month of April. Ordinarily, April has a surplus because it's income tax time. And this month of April, 2010, it was $87 billion, $87 billion. And they keep printing more, and they keep selling more bonds, and every time they put more money into circulation, the net effect of it is it dilutes the money supply that's already out there, and it bids up prices, and there's coming a point in time when we're going to have runaway inflation. Now, I've just told you a story. I told you the story about the paper money in the colonies. Now, I told you a second story here. I told you the story about gold and silver. Now, with these two stories, the story from yesterday and the story from today, are you and I, are we able then to put this together and say, hyperinflation, boys and girls? Because that's what we had in 1783, hyperinflation. Now, 1933's collapse was just exactly the opposite. It was a deflation. So what do you think we're going to have this next round? Is it going to be deflation or hyperinflation? Well, what are these people doing? They're printing money like it's going out of style. And the budget deficit in April of 2009 was $20 billion. And the budget deficit for April of 2010 is $87 billion, so it's blown out four times greater. Well, what do you think the budget deficit's going to be in April of 2011? Do you think they're going to print less money or more money? You know, what have they been telling us? What are we hearing? What's the game plan? What's the agenda here? Well, it looks like to me, just based upon what I'm watching and what I'm seeing, and it looks like to me, I apply my knowledge, I read the paper, and then I put my understanding, the stories that I've heard in the past, that I just told you yesterday and today. And then this leads me to the wisdom of the story, and that is, well, what do I think the probable outcome is going to be? And so little Georgie Gordon sits over and says, you know, I don't want any paper money. I only want gold and silver, or wheat, or corn, or beans, or honey, or oil, or land, or cattle, or something else. I don't want any mortgages, interest, paper money. That's just what my common sense. Now, the word common sense and wisdom are synonymous terms. It's that my granddad said, you know, that guy ain't got a lick of common sense. My old grandmother used to say, well, that guy ain't got sense enough to carry guts to a barrel. And, you know, the old timers, you know, that's the way they talk. Now, in the Bible, God uses the word wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. He says, you know, you want to get wisdom, understanding, and knowledge ahead of gold and silver. It'll serve you better. All right, so now I'm not going to tell you what to do. I'm just throwing this out there to you and saying, okay, now what do you think? What does your common sense tell you? Do you think that the government of the United States is going to rein in its spending and is going to go back to gold and silver and start issuing gold and silver and pulling this paper in like we did in 1787? Do you believe it? I don't see any indications of that. I don't believe it for a minute. I think we're going to go on inflating until we go into hyperinflation and we destroy the economy. Now, here's what's going to happen. That'll produce famine. That'll produce shortages. Hyperinflation dilutes the money supply to such a degree there isn't any corresponding goods on the shelf. You know, just because you print twice as much money doesn't make twice as many mayonnaise jars on the shelf or twice as many cars on the showroom floor or twice as many tires, you know, in the factory or in the warehouse. Goods have to be produced by labor. Now, God's solution to this is that money should be produced by labor. So when we go out and we dig gold out of the ground, and we put that gold into circulation by spending it into money, or turning it into money and then spending it in the society, then the money is put into circulation by labor. And the people that are making boards and cars and tires and all the goods out here, they're making their goods with labor. And then we all trade that labor, those goods, those services, and there's no inflation. Between 1865 and 1900, there was zero inflation. In fact, there was 2% deflation. Your money was worth 2 cents more in 1900 than it was in 1865. We built 286,000 miles of railroad. It was the greatest period of economic expansion in the history of the nation, 1865 to 1900, 35 years. Gold and silver coin. Now we went to paper, and we've been on a slippery slope. We've spent ourselves into oblivion, and right now our economy is at a point. We owe $100 trillion. It's more than that. Hell, we've got derivatives that are $1,000 trillion. But I'm just looking at the debt that we know about. We got $100 trillion. We can't even pay the interest on it. We're printing the money to pay the interest on it right now. Our economic car is already airborne and on its way over the guardrail. It's totally out of control. You're not going to salvage that. As individuals in the car, we need to brace for the collapse. We need to brace for the crash. And whether or not we survive this crash is going to be how well do we get padded between now and the time this thing hits the first tree. And we don't have very much time. Now, there's the story. Do we learn anything from these stories? Because these stories are what make for wisdom. It makes for common sense. There's a conclusion that's going to come from this. Our Congress spending money, bailing out these banks, is going to have a conclusion. There's going to be an outcome to this. Now, is the outcome that's coming from this the outcome that you're expecting? Is it the outcome that you want? Is this the way you want this thing to turn out? If it isn't, then you need to take action right now. While you've got control over your own family finances, your own home, your own car, your own money, you know, you've got control over your IRA and your Krog plan and so on right now. But Congress is planning to take that from you. Now, are you going to wait until they take it, or are you going to take action in advance? Those are the kinds of decisions that knowledge, wisdom, and understanding produce. All right, I'm about out of time, so I'm going to have to give you a final reminder here that you have been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. That's for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, there's a signal that says our time's up. I'm going to have to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.